Welcome to the podcast, Agia Goes Viral. We here at the Arab-German Young Academy of Sciences and Humanities, Agia for short, invite you to join us as we explore the diverse implications of COVID-19 for science and society at large. In each episode, Arab and German Agia members and alumni from different scientific disciplines come together to discuss research on and amidst the coronavirus pandemic. In today's podcast episode, Agia member Dr. Amr Ali from Egypt and Agia alumnus Dr. Kalman Graffi from Germany discuss coronavirus warning apps, delving into their advantages, disadvantages, and effectiveness from both a technological and ethical point of view. Amr Ali is a lecturer in political sociology at the American University in Cairo, while Kalman Graffi is a principal scientist at the Honda Research Institute Europe located in Offenbach am Main.
Hello, how are you, Amro?
Hi, Kalman, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. As most people, I'm working from home and face the same challenges and potentially new working environment as well. It is interesting how quickly remote working options are explored now, and I'm curious what elements will prevail at the end of the pandemic. How did you perceive the times of the lockdown?
Well, that's a very good question. I can say that for me, the idea of time has become distorted and the idea of space has also become skewed, perhaps because one has never really experienced this type of historical event on one's life on the microscopic level. I would say that this time has reminded one how fast life used to be before. It used to be very fast. I think we were living, you know, the Flying Dutchman syndrome. The Flying Dutchman was the legend and Dutch folklore that had the ship leave Holland. So with the Flying Dutchman, you had this ship that was condemned to sail the seas forever, and it could not dock port. It was what they would call the undead. They could not live and they could not die. And this is what life on mutant capitalism, I would say, was very much like prior to the pandemic. But also it has given me a space and time to learn drawing, as well as writing short stories and picking up some poetry. So there is a creative side of me that has flourished, I would say, under the pandemic. So Kalman, I would like to ask you, since mid-June, a Corona One app by the federal government is available in Germany. Have you downloaded it already?
Yes, I have followed its development from the beginning, actually. I was very interested in it because it touches two points that I'm interested in also from research perspective. One is about communication and one is about IT security and privacy-preserving computation. So it was very interesting to follow how it is developed and how also the organization takes place. And I was looking at it when the first pan-European privacy-preserving proximity tracing consortium, in short PEP-PT, was established. And a side note on that, it's very interesting how small the world is. So I knew several people in that consortium before joining. So at the end, we also joined. So then there was a discussion and some scientific debate as well on the right directions of that consortium, also followed up by the Decentralized Privacy Preserving Proximity Tracing Consortium, in short, the DP3T. So very lots of acronyms that are used. And at the end, also a telecom and SAP taking over at the end. So I was following the development, the technical and ethical discussions, the research questions followed by it. And of course, now I have the app installed. I felt obliged to do it. And I can also summarize, it's very simple to install. I recommend it. And I also saw that it has surpassed 50 million downloads. So it sounds that it's also catching up and is getting a success as well. However, there's also a small disappointment in using it. So staying at home, it only shows me low risk and probably I do not meet enough people. It should also not be an incentive to get a different result in this. But it's similar to other apps that we used to install once and never use again. But that's fine. And I'm interested and I'm looking forward to see whether this will change. But I hope that the low risk status will stay. So is there a similar app in Egypt? And do you probably know also how the app works?
There is no similar app in Egypt. And the reason for that is that not everyone in Egypt has a smartphone, and phone coverage cannot reach all areas of Egypt. The other point would be that there is no way to force people to download the app. It would take a massive, massive educational campaign and movements to get people to use the app. And I don't think people could do that because they don't have the luxury of distance. Egypt is, we're talking about 100 million people who are squeezed along the Nile and across the North Coast. So distance and social distancing is a luxury, at least for many, for the majority of the population. The other point is that I would say the priorities of people is wanting to survive. And coronavirus is a problem for sure, but there are other daily existential threats that people face that they need to survive. Remember, this is a country with 30% of the population under the poverty line. And so when you throw the coronavirus into the mix, it doesn't raise the same concern level versus trying to make a daily living to survive, because they live day to day on subsistence. So these questions are something that circulates in society. People are trying their best to keep a social distancing or wearing the mask, but it's not on the level of an efficient fight against the coronavirus. And this has a lot to do with the socio-economic factors in the country. And therefore, an app wouldn't make any sense. It would be great to have an app, I think, in Egypt. But the infrastructure and the circumstances are not easily available to make it possible to use the app. But can I ask you, as a computer scientist, can you tell me how exactly does the app by the federal government in Germany work?
Yes, that's a good question. And actually, it's quite complex also to put it in a picture, but I try to boil it down to its simple ideas. So the main aim of the app is to inform its users about probabilities of having met infected other users of the app. In this, it is important to be privacy preserving. So there has been examples like in Hong Kong or in Singapore, where they use also a tracing app, but which was very going over its privacy boundaries. So there they used to track identities and locations and match it to who has been in the same surrounding at the same time. This putting together the locations and the identities is very obstructive and also very aggressive, as it can really identify who has met whom at what time, and that has political implications. So for the app, these locations are not needed. So what it requires that the identity of the user should not be tracked. The location of the user should not be tracked. Ideally, as well, the social interactions of the users should not be tracked. And also what other actions are happening around the smartphone should not be tracked. So it should be as anonymous as possible and should not reveal any further information about the user. In addition, and in contrast, it should be in a way that once an infection is diagnosed at one of its users and the patient reveals this to the app with the support of a doctor, so to confirm it, the app should then inform all persons who have been in close distance in the past days and thus have a probability to be infected as well. So it sounds a little bit contradicting, but how is it working? So technically, it is solved quite elegantly. So first of all, the app uses a way of identification, namely in form of random numbers or random codes that do not tell anything about the identity of the users. And the users are daily generating a new set of random codes that they are using throughout the day. So again, the user knows how to generate the codes, but the codes cannot be identified back or linked back to the user. So, and these random codes are then memorized by the app and used throughout the day. So now the user walks around and shares this daily or hourly random codes with other app users in the surrounding. For that, it has to be closer than a specific range, which is about 2 meters, and for a quite longer period of time. So it's not sufficient to be in a close proximity for seconds. It has to be several minutes. And the random codes of other apps are picked up during that time. So every user of the app is spreading his random codes and picking up the random codes of others. How's that done? So technically, Bluetooth Low Energy is used to periodically send out the current random codes. It allows to communicate in a very close distance over a few meters, and also allows to measure quite precisely the distance of the sending smartphone. Thus, a quite good approximation of the closeness of two individuals can be made. Okay, so then you walk around and then you capture these random codes of people you don't know. And over the day, you have a large number of these random codes that you memorize, so the app memorizes it, and that's it. So now the next step happens if someone is infected and reveals this to the app and the doctor confirms it. Then the app identifies their own personal random codes used in the past and marks them as infected, stating a potential infection threat. So these infected codes, to call them so, are then sent to all Corona One app users over supporting infrastructure. And now everyone gets periodically, daily, a list of infected codes, and they can locally check whether they have met these codes, comparing their memorized codes with the infected codes. If there's no match, everything is fine. The probability of infection is low. But if there's a match, depending on the number of matches and the distances that have been memorized, then the app can compute a probability of infection and can display it to the user. And as a last step, if such a probability of infection has been presented to the user is asked or suggested to make a test and to inform his doctor and to take the next steps. It's all remaining voluntarily. And the nice thing about it is that it's also not revealing any kind of further information to any other party. Just the user itself is informed what potential risk he faces. So in conclusion, the app is well functioning and wants the persons at risk and is supporting this privacy preserving requirements that were stated initially. So you have been living in Berlin. Is the Arab-Egyptian diaspora in Berlin using the app?
Thank you, Kelman. That's a good question. I'm not aware of the numbers of the Arab diaspora that's using the app, but I can say they are certainly taking the pandemic seriously. It's a surprise to them as well, because the ideal community is important, but now they have to learn to isolate until this pandemic is over. But one of the problems the apps would probably trigger in their memory is, given that many of them will be exiles and refugees, is the idea of surveillance back at home. And so they might be also ambivalent about the use of the app, feeling that they're being tracked and they're being surveilled, and that there might be a risk to their life from governmental forces.
I understand.
I have heard that this technology so far does not work on some older mobile phones. So why is this the case?
You are right. This Corona One app requires some technical elements that has to be given in the smartphone. So first of all, very old phones that do not allow to install that app, of course, are ruled out. They cannot participate. But also Android and iOS devices, which are newer, but do not have the newest operating system, they cannot participate. Or maybe they can participate, but with strong limitations. I would like to say a few words on that. So first of all, the smartphone needs to support Bluetooth Low Energy, which is a specific form and version of the Bluetooth technology and which has been developed only in recent years. So very old phones not supporting that communication over specific frequencies and following that specific data format and do not have the support through the operating system to emulate it, they cannot participate. And second, there are also smartphones which do not support through the operating system that the app can work in the background. So typically, a smartphone is also a small computer with its operating system, and the operating system decides which app gets resources in terms of memory, CPU time, and with that also decides which functions can be active. And in previous smartphones and in previous versions of the operating system, it was only available to run Bluetooth applications while they are in the foreground, so while the app is actively open. But once you close it, then the communication stops. And this is, of course, not advantageous for the distant and the envisioned use case, so where the app should be running all the time. So and to support to run in the background, just recently, prior to the publishing of the Corona One app, there has been made advancements in the operating system Android by Google and iOS by Apple to support that these applications can run also in the background. And smartphones who do not have the newest operating system just cannot do it, or they have to keep the app open all the time, which is quite not reflecting the typical use case.
From what I understand, though, that this Corona One app helps to determine whether one has had any contact with an infected person, which could result in a risk of catching the virus. So how many people need to use the app for the desired effect to occur?
Yeah, that's a great question, as there has been lots of questions in that direction also in the media, just to question the need of such an app. And technically, to speak, the app also is usable with two users only. So if there would be one single user who has the app and he's infected, and there's a second user who gets in the proximity and close by to that first infected user, the second one would be informed. So even with two users and one of them being infected, it already works. So while it is also working for two users, of course, these apps are envisioned to be used by millions of users. And actually, this is a question of probabilities and numbers. The more users are using the app, the better, and the higher the probability that all infections, or the most of the infections that are happening, are also digitally monitored by the app. So just to give an example, let's assume we have 1,000 persons and they walk around, and we have 100 meetings where an infection might happen. And if 10 out of these 100 close by meetings are resulting in an infection, then let's have a look what happens if no one has the app. So if these 10 meetings where the disease is spread on is not supported by the app, then the patients will find out later and will themselves carry the virus around and act as a spreader. So let's assume that 20% of the users have the app installed. Then let's say out of these 10 infections, 20% of them are captured by the app, and the persons who might be infected are now informed before they can meet further people. So then already the infection rate is pushed a little bit further down, as these people, although not experiencing actual symptoms of the disease, might still get the information that they are infected. And now if we increase the number of people using the app to 70%, out of these 10 meetings where infection happens, if 7 of them are informed prior to knowing it and experiencing it themselves through symptoms, much smaller number of actually infectious people will walk around. So the app is working already with small numbers, and probabilities are getting higher and higher the more people are using it, so that the infections are reported earlier and symptoms that have not been yet perceived are still not leading to further on infections of other people. So the app is just a support in restricting infected people of spreading it further on when they do not know it.
Well, I would like to ask, what controversy has been in the development? Why were some scientists critical?
You're right. That was a quite interesting effect that we had been facing in the creation of the Corona One app. And I've followed it in the past from its beginning, from PEP-PT, the first consortium, to DP3T, the second consortium, and then finally to taking over by SAP and Telecom. And especially there was some public dispute on the design decisions taken in the first place. And also the politics were in first favor in the first approach, then the second approach, and finally giving it to the third party. So that has been quite confusing, and I would like to bring some light into that. So the first consortium, PEP-PT, standing for the Pan-European Privacy Preserving Proximity Tracing Consortium, quite long name. This first consortium was aiming for a more centralized approach for running the app. That means that the random codes that the users are now spreading through the app and identifying their person, so that helps to match together whom to inform when an infection occurs. So these random codes in the first approach were designed to be set up by the Robert Koch Institute, so by a central party, which is in charge of generating these keys. And this central party would spread out the keys to the various users. They walk around, they spread their codes. And once an infection occurs, that specific person with his app informs the central entity that he's infected, and the central entity would then match who is to be informed. The benefits, and this is also what France is doing currently, so they are still following that centralized approach, how it is called. The benefits are that the central entity can much more analyze what is happening and how the infection status is, as it has the close view of how many people are infected and how many other people have been met by these infected people. So there are some options to really utilize that information and to learn from it, and also to adapt the risk determination of when someone is infected and when not. But there has been the dispute on this case, especially with regard to how much is the central entity to be trusted. So this Robert Koch Institute and maybe some governmental institutes would be in the possession of the knowledge of who is infected, whom they met, and at what frequency this happens. And this was conceived by the second consortium then, that it would be too much revealing. So at the worst case, the government could find out who is who meeting whom, and with some additional attacks, as it is called, with some specific setup, the government could also learn at which position the people are, at what times, whom they meet, and have a social interaction map, actually, to really learn what the citizens do. That was considered as potentially high risk to the app. And so the second consortium was created. It was very interesting how the politics were motivating the first approach and then switching to the decentralized approach. As I explained, the decentralized approach is focusing on the users creating their random codes, and no central entity will learn who these codes belong to. So what is currently happening is that the users, they walk around, they gather the codes, and once they're infected, they spread it to everyone. And this spreading to everyone, this is supported by some central infrastructure, that's fine, but there's no information revealed of who is behind these codes. So still, there are some risks there, how this specific app can lead to some surveillance. But at the end, it's much more assuming on the trust of the central party.
It's interesting what you say, Carmen, and it begs the question, though, and I guess it follows up from what you were saying, is how secure is it in terms of privacy now?
So having had the previous centralized approach that was dismissed by not wanting to trust the central entity, which will be the government at the end, so now we have a much more decentralized approach. Where the users are in charge of handling their data, and only the users themselves will learn whom they met and what infection risk they take. But still, it also comes with specific concerns and drawbacks. So currently, a simple non-infected user, you reveal no information about yourself, no identity, no location, just a random non-personal code. That's fine. As infected user, your identity and location is not revealed. It does not even reveal further information on you, even if you spread your infection status to all other users in that system. Ideally, and how it is implemented now, no privacy leaks happen. Still, there are some theoretical attacks. With specific infrastructure set up, one could misuse the system to learn more about its participants. So for example, what is possible with some specific theoretic setup is to find out whom of your contact partners is infected. So if you would have, let's say, 10 friends, and for all of these friends, you have a specific smartphone with a specific copy of the CoronaWarn app, then if one of them is infected, you could learn that if that specific smartphone you used with your friend when meeting him is showing an infection risk, then you know that your specific friend is infected. So if the current approach, theoretically, and with some quite work to do, you could find out whom in your neighborhood, whom in your friend's social circle is infected with corona. This would have not been possible with the previous approach, but you always have to make compromises. In addition, one has still the option that even though the CoronaWarn app is currently open source and you can see what is happening and you can see that there are no risks implemented in the code currently, you could still trust it in the current state. But later on, when updates to the app come up, people might not check in very detail what is updated at that point. And over time, the provider of the app could add more and more hidden features and surveilling features. And having a state where millions of users have installed the app and they don't look at it at all until they are warned, the app provider could more and more add additional functionality that are undesired by the users, but are not really detected. So that attack still is doable and might happen, but it's very, very unlikely. So currently there's no risk stated by the app, and it's really doing its job and functioning well. But in future, if the users are not cautious, additional harmful features can be added. So, but now I can just recommend to use it. It's very well done and working fine. I have also a question for you. You are a sociologist. So what is your perspective on the Corona Warn app? Is there a worrying precedent that these type of apps set for the future?
Thank you, Kalman. That's a very good question. And it raises many questions as well and many concerns. From the outset, I would say that it normalizes very dangerous, peculiar, and worrying and big brother style technological practices. What we used to see in the movies in the 1970s or 1980s that deal with science fiction, this is becoming a reality for many people. What we thought was the realm of fantasy is becoming the realm of the real world. And one can be empirical about it and just look at specifically what is worrying about it and what precedent it sets. First of all, from what we see from these apps, there is no mechanism to opt in or opt out of third-party trackers, which are included with the app. This might not be the case in Germany, but it's certainly the case in many other countries who are using a similar type of app. It seems that the app would only work when it is operating on the foreground, particularly on iOS devices, making its efficiency questionable. And even experts have pointed out that the app is incompatible with a range of older Android devices, potentially putting the most vulnerable, such as those who are elderly and those on low incomes, at big risk. Some critics also have pointed out that the app will effectively give governments and third parties access to people's data. Some civil rights groups said that the government must take such risks seriously. And so far, governments around the world have given lip service to this, to the idea that privacy is being respected, but it's not being reflected in concrete legal measures. And some would even say that using the app should not be a condition to leaving the lockdown or returning to work, although that is certainly a debatable point because after all, we're talking about people's health that is at risk. Other governments use the centralized model, so meaning the matching process will take place on a computer server, making it at high risk to external attack and the exploitation of people's data. Now, the reassurances that governments say will be that claiming data would be only be held as long as it was needed and that all data will be handled according to the highest ethical and security standards. But this also is questionable given that we've seen what has happened with data on other devices and other apps in the past. There is nothing to give one reassurance that this will be respected. But also critics warn this kind of system would be imprecise, since some phones would detect signals from 30 meters away while being unable to determine the distance. Also, another concern would be that the interference can also prevent two phones noticing each other when and within 2 meters. As one study has said, that many matches would be missed while others would be recorded by mistake. But the bigger picture is that digital contact tracing will be less able to control for variables such as ventilation, direction of wind, or environment, factors that are normally central to manual contact tracing efforts. And overall, the digital contact tracing will be vulnerable to all forms of fraud and abuse, from people using multiple devices, false reports of infection, to denial of service attacks by adversarial actors. So these are the factors that we need to take into consideration when operating such devices. The future does not look promising if simply to save lives, which is a very important point, we will be sacrificing many, many liberties in the process.
So I agree with you that it should be strictly opt-in, so requiring the consent of the user to use it. Some words on the technical elements, on the imprecision, I could also say as well. So I did myself Bluetooth measurements and it still looks good. So from the error ratio, so even though you are close of 2 meters, the ratios are in the centimeters how high the error is. But I agree. So technology seems to getting a big impact now at during this crisis. So what does this say about the pace of technology in relation to the human condition?
The British author and novelist Ian Forster, he wrote a novella in 1908 called The Machine Stops. And it was very prophetic of a future where people will be isolated in their homes with tablet devices and communicating only through these devices, not meeting other human beings. So it's worrying that one can say that much of that is being played out in reality. it's not part of the realm of conspiracy theories or science fiction films. No, we are seeing this happen. The problem that it also raises is the scourge of techno-fundamentalism. What is techno-fundamentalism? It is the belief that technology is not only the means and will to triumph over adversity through gadgets and schemes, but the sense that invention is the best of all possible methods of confronting problems. At its essence, techno-fundamentalism sidesteps politics in favor of taking on social problems and translating them into technical solutions. When technological thinking becomes central to political thought, it draws high risks to civil society, to the idea of citizenship, to social movements, as now all these actors become arranged around platforms and abstractions, while weakening the link between political awareness of citizens and locally rooted action. And this happens also because people become automized, stuck in their apartments, tied to digital tracking devices. And then because of that, there's a deterioration of the communal aspect. And to be human is to be part of a community. And to be part of a community is to be human. And this is disintegrating. And what raises the concern is that there is no sort of post-corona future of community. It's not in the discussion. The app is moving towards a process of normalization.
Some interesting points that you mentioned, especially reflecting the words on the book, where communication is only taking place from home through devices and overcoming the current, let's say, needs of meeting people in a society. I must say some parts of it are also typical for computer scientists that like to communicate from home and that potentially picked up some parts of the technologies earlier on. So I have some mixed feelings about it. I must say, as I also heard when I was much younger, people complaining about the youth writing emails instead of letters. So maybe the society is progressing and these novel options of technology are supporting it, maybe also defining it. That might be.
Kalman, I wanted to ask, is the current technological approach for the Corona War app in Germany also to recommend in any country?
So what summary can I give for using the app in other countries? So the current form of the app is very well usable, as it both protects its users, meaning the citizens walking around with the app. It protects them from malicious or harmful behavior of other citizens trying to troll the system, trying to put in some fake infections to see the effect. But also it is secure from misbehavior from the organizations that are organizing it, like the governments or the Robert Koch Institute, which is, I think, from my experience, also required, as data security and data privacy are very crucial elements to implement and quite difficult to do. And the less you assume that people and organizations do it right, the better.
So what risks remain?
So there are always risks in life and in using technologies. Avoiding all risks is not possible. And there will be always a remaining small probability that something might happen that you did not expect. Nevertheless, the Corona Warn app is recommended to be used, while at the same time, we should closely follow its development. It should remain opt-in. This means require the consent of the user, both in its usage as well as the interpretation of its results. And I'm happy that it's there, the app, to support the tracing of infections and to allow people to much earlier inform them about potential infection that they might have not found out yet.
Thank you, Kelman.
You're welcome, Amro. Nice to talk to you. So, goodbye.
You too. Great to talk to you. Bye-bye. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the podcast, Agia Goes Viral. You can find all of the podcast episodes on our website, agia.info. That's AGYA.INFO. Until next time, please stay healthy and safe.